Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and you are here on your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you are in Hood River, and in Corvallis, Albany, Salem, 100.7 on the web, KBOO.FM. Good morning. Yes, it's gray, but it's no reason to give up. No, be bright and sunny internally.
And externally, to share the joy and the sunshine in our lives.
I love that. That
excellent.
Worked for me.
Hey, so much is happening in our world today. And as we wake up this morning and realize that what are things that are happening, we have an exciting program for you this morning that will help stimulate you intellectually and hopefully also inspire you as you face the challenges of this day. Much has been written and talked about in recent week about the role of government and what it can do and what it cannot do. This morning, we will have a conversation with two interesting folks who will help us review about a time in our nation's history when some of these questions were asked and challenges met by those who thought that there was a role for government. We'll speak this morning about the New Deal legacy and what government can do at its best. Our guests this morning are two people who have written and studied much about this role and will offer us their insights. Joining us this morning is historical geographer Gray Brecken by phone and Sarah Baker Monroe here in the studio. Mr. Brecken is a author and historical geographer, and Ms. Monroe is a board member of the National New Deal Preservation Association and a author of Timberline Lodge, The History, Art, and Craft of an American Icon. Thank you two for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Great. Thank you for joining us. I should tell our listeners that you will be here in Portland on tomorrow evening at Portland State University Smith Center, Room 238, the Browsing Lounge, and you will be speaking on your book, The Imperial San Francisco Urban Power and Earthy Ruin. So we'll look forward to your visit here in our lovely city.
Thank you very much.
Well, Cecil opened up by talking about what the government could and could not do, what it has and has not done, or, you know, in terms of cooperative visionary efforts. And I also wanted to just throw in there what it should and should not do. But one of the most important things, I think, is just to have one of those recaps historically of how we've had some visionary efforts to kind of rally our economic sinkings or our emotional or national sinkings when, as a quote-unquote team, the country has faltered in its steps. And I thought maybe just kind of an overview for you of maybe one or two of the big highlights that came out of the New Deal that still affect us and color how we look at what government can, can't, should, shouldn't do.
Sarah, should I?
Please.
Do that?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, we have to start with the stock market crash of 1929. And that's what everybody remembers as sort of the beginning of the Depression, but the Great Depression, the previous Depression. But in fact, actually, the Depression had started before that for farmers. 1929, the fall of 29, is actually when everybody experienced it, when the stock market crashed. And then it just kept going down for the next about 4 years or so. So by 1932, Americans were ready for a real change from Herbert Hoover, who didn't seem to be able to do anything about it. He just wasn't capable of dealing with the Great Depression. So Franklin Roosevelt comes in as a Democrat in March 4th, 1932. He's inaugurated. And almost immediately, he begins launching what he calls the New Deal. And that was a series of programs to kick the U.S. economy back into health by starting a series of, well, regulating business for the first time, really, so that we wouldn't have another depression. But also, there was a whole package of recovery, and among that was the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC, which was an army of young men who did enormous improvements in our parks and state parks, national parks. And then there was the Public Works Administration, which was grants and loans from the federal government to local public agencies. And then in 1935, you get the very famous WPA, the Works Progress Administration, which was a workforce paid directly by the federal government. Eventually, 8.5 million Americans worked for the WPA, and they did an enormous range of things, creating our airports, many of our hospitals, our public schools, public parks, fire stations, and all of this is still with us, or a great deal of it still is. It's all around us. We just don't see it. Now, as a geographer, I'm interested in seeing that invisible landscape, and what we're doing in California is mapping it with the California Living New Deal project. We called it the Living New Deal because it never went away. We're still using it all the time. Every time you turn on a faucet and get clean water, that's largely thanks to the infrastructure that they built during the New Deal. It's just that we don't realize that.
And some of it was not only hidden, but it continues to be very, very public. And Sarah, we referred much in this past week with the weather and the snow here in Portland and people going up to skiing. Part of the visible living legacy of the New Deal is something you're familiar with.
That's right. I think probably the people in Oregon are most familiar with Timberline Lodge, which was a WPA project that Gray was referring to, the Works Progress Administration, and that was built between 1936 and 1938, and we've been very fortunate in Oregon that it has continued to be a real example of the WPA. It has not only its exterior structure, but most of the furnishings and the artwork in the lodge are original and were produced under the WPA, under the Federal Art Project. And so we really do have an icon here in our state in the Timberline Lodge. There are many other examples, too. Our municipal airport was moved over from Swan Island, and that was all under a WPA project. It employed about 1,000 workers, and most of them were using just shovels. One of the ideas of the WPA was to have as many unskilled workers put to work as possible. And so a lot of times their equipment would be very rudimentary. Rocky Butte was also built under the WPA and a lot of our local parks in the Portland area. I think one thing that we don't see that speaks to what Gray was talking about with the invisible landscape were the highways along that take people to the coast, the Wolf Creek and Wilson River highways were constructed under WPA as well, and it wasn't until the New Deal that Highway 101 was a through road. Before that time, people had to take ferries across most of the rivers. Mm-hmm. Those were Public Works Administration projects, and the tunnel at Neoconee was also built under a Public Works project of the New Deal.
And, of course, state capital as well, too.
Yes, that's right. That our capital had burned in 35 and a new one was built by 38, exactly. And also the state library. So there are many. The state library.
Yes, excellent. And we're speaking this morning with Sarah Monroe and Gray Brecken. We're speaking about the New Deal, its living legacy, and we invite you to participate in our morning conversation as we uncover much about some things that are hidden and compare and contrast the times of the 75 years and today. Our numbers here are
503-231-8187.
And I want to continue a little bit about putting it in this historical setting. Gray began some of this in talking about the depression that confronted the New Dealers in the early 1930s. What were some of the social and economic forces, in addition to the stock market, that that compel political leaders to take specific actions. What motivated Mr. Roosevelt and others to say that we need to do something very aggressive to change the situation?
Well, I think part of the problem was that compelled him to do that is that nobody knew where the bottom was. The market and the economy just kept dropping, and people were in a state of panic, literal panic, by the time that Roosevelt came in. He famously said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And what he meant was that people were terrorized. Because remember that this is before the social safety net that the New Deal put into place, things like federal deposit insurance, for example. So that when the banks began closing around the time that he became president, there was no insurance, and you would lose all of any money that you had in a bank when the bank went down. And they were going down like dominoes. So first there was terror, and then there was anger. And there was a genuine fear of revolution at that time because people were just furious about this. And so Roosevelt has to take some pressure off of the system, and he does that by allowing labor unions to organize. And that results in a whole series of gigantic strikes in 34, 35, many of many reactionaries felt that that was actually the beginning of a revolution. But in fact, what Roosevelt did was to steer a middle course, taking pressure off of the system. He actually saved capitalism for itself. But his enemies have never forgiven him, actually. They've never given him the credit for actually saving capitalism.
You're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Phone number is 503-231-8187. And I'm sitting here chuckling, Gray, thinking about how, you know, you cannot get forgiveness for saving capitalism. And we're sitting here, oh, how many years later? You know, yes, it is in a weakened state, but that's more, I think, a function of greed for some folks, maybe not totally. And people still haven't quite figured out the good that he's done and given him the total credit. And one wonders what kind of parallel are we seeing in the current administration, if there are some parallels. But I'd like to examine that a little closer in a moment. We have folks online here, and so we'll go to our callers.
Maggie.
Good morning, Maggie. Hello. Good morning.
Comment to make. I am.
Oh, okay, Maggie, can you back up? Because we didn't get you on right at the beginning there.
Oh, okay, that's fine. So I have a comment to make. I have heard a lot about how, I mean, obviously our schools are pretty depleted here, first of all, always with funding, but I understand that if we were to rebuild and restructure some of our schools as far as making them better equipped for our students, that would create an immense amount of jobs here just in the Portland area, not to mention the nation. And then the other thought is, you know, I know that a lot of people are now more than ever visiting our parks and wanting more parks and, you know, really utilizing them for community gatherings, for learning about nature, for just a whole bunch of other stuff. And yet they're talking about closing these parks down. And I'm thinking to myself that there's been more than ever an increase in people going to them. And so I imagine that even some of the parks could either we could create more parks or community gardens, or we could even, create, again, fix the parks that we do have and how that would create more jobs. So can your guests talk about that?
Well, thank you for the questions. Good questions. Sarah, I'd love to hear what you're thinking.
I think that sounds like a great idea. Our schools, I mean, that's exactly what they did in the New Deal, was to have the schools decorated with art that is still there in many of the Portland public schools. C.S. Price murals, beautiful murals, and wood marquetry. And that artwork itself actually even needs to be restored to have school programs and parks, state parks. Silver Creek Falls was a CCC project.
That's a beautiful place, too.
It is. Mm-hmm. And original Myrtlewood furniture, yes. Handmade. And the Jesse Honeyman State Park was also a CCC park. And I think that's an excellent idea. One of the things the CCC did when it was started right after Roosevelt's inauguration in the spring of 1933 was to put young men to work, these young men between the ages of 19 and 25 who basically were just kind of wandering around, and they were hungry, too. Oregon benefited greatly from that workforce in the national forests where they built trails and campgrounds, and it also saved, I think, a lot of social unrest in the country because these people were employed. I saw a statistic one place that said once the, all men, I think, basically, but once they were came under the CCC, they gained an average of about 11 and a half pounds in 3 months, and that shows you how hungry people were.
Wow. Could I just say that they had this odd idea, because it wasn't just that the nation was threatened by revolution, it was also threatened by rising levels of crime and juvenile delinquency, and the New Dealers had this strange idea that it's much cheaper and better for society to educate people than to punish them. So they actually built thousands of new schools, which are so well built that most of them are still in operation. I'll be talking about that at Portland State and University of Oregon and Willamette in the next few days. It's a book that I'm working on right now. It was a huge expansion in aid to public education. But Maggie was correct, too, that they also created all of these parks and recreational facilities and democratized sports, like skiing, for example, at Timberline Lodge, because they knew that people would have to be occupied once the economy took off again, and even during the Depression, they didn't want those people going off to prisons. That's very expensive.
You know, and that's such a valuable lesson if we could only just pay attention to some of the very basic, just not even ornate, not complex, very simple and elegant lessons. Employed people and people who are not hungry are the wealth of the nation. Really simple. We have
absolutely.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I found that many of the public tennis courts that we have are baseball diamonds. Many of our recreational facilities are 70 to 75 years old. They were created at that time.
You're listening this morning to More Talk Radio. Our topic this day is the New Deal legacy, what government at its best can do. Our guests are Gary Brecken, who is an author and historical geographer, who will be speaking at Portland State University on tomorrow, Tuesday, April 6th at 7 p.m. And also joining us is Sarah Baker Monroe, who is a board member of the National New Deal Preservation Association and author of Timberline Lodge, The History, Art, and Craft of American Icon.
And we have other callers here in the buffer, so we'll have them on and then get back to some of our questions. Good morning, you're on the air.
Hello, is that me?
That would be you.
Yes, it's good to hear people talking about the Depression times and the WPA and because I never learned about that or much about it in school when I was in school. I was born in 1935, and I have seen how people's lives and thinking have drastically changed since then. But I've been listening to a lot of these experts and people like that on C-SPAN and NPR and even on KABU and that, and they talk about the Depression and those times as if they lived then. And you know, my family didn't talk about much about what happened to them during the Depression and the years later. I don't know whether it's because it was painful, but what gets me, I've been listening for some time to, you know, about these experts and so forth, you know, talking about it as if they knew what it was like. Thank you for listening.
One of the projects I understand of the New Deal was a project such as oral history of
yes,
those who lived earlier, before the New Deal, like slavery, ex-slaves. Are there done things similarly done in terms of remembering the legacy of the New Deal, Mr. Brecken?
Well, we're trying to do that, actually, with the California Living New Deal project. We're collecting testimonials. I wish I had a larger staff, actually, like the WPA, to send people out, because we need to get these memories. And the caller is absolutely right. Whenever I'm been interviewed on the radio about the project, I'll often have among my first callers somebody who hates Roosevelt and has drunk the Kool-Aid about how he prolonged the Depression or even caused the Depression, and it was only the war that brought us out of the Depression. And this largely comes from a writer named Amity Schles, who wrote a book about this, and people have just picked it up, and you've heard it on the floor of Congress. And then what almost always happens after that is we get a string of callers who are in their 80s and 90s who say exactly what the caller just said. Let me put you straight. Let me tell you what it was really like and what Roosevelt did. And they'll often say, Roosevelt saved my family. And you'll just hear this over and over again. So you really have to get the memories of the people who were there. And I would also like to say that, you know, sending people out, interviewers out, to get the slave narratives, the memories of people at the end of their lives who had actually experienced slavery, that's indicative of the tremendous ingenuity, the compassion in the New Deal. They really had visionaries working for them. Whoever thought of doing something like that? Well, that's now one of the most used resources in the National Archives.
Well, you know, I want to suggest something to you, Gray, before I forget it, and that's because I'm an alumnus. But when you talk about something analogous to the CCC or to the WPA, and in these day and age, and you talk about having people to go out and do that work, don't forget AmeriCorps.
Well, yes, but that's really,
I know it's
extension.
Slightly different. I know it's slightly different, but you know, you have everything for the Conservation Corps to the Senior Corps, and that might be just what you need to go out and have your people collect the stories, because we are a versatile crew. You know, they still keep asking us to come back, and AmeriCorps has the National Civilian Community Corps as well.
That's an excellent suggestion. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really good idea. I know our family's participated in AmeriCorps, too, and to expand that to be able to add to our archive. I think if it hadn't been for the folklore, oral history components of the New Deal, we would have lost so much richness of our history. It was really...
Wasn't there an interview with the woman who really essentially coordinated Timberline Lodge?
Well, you mean since the New Deal, not under the New Deal?
Yes.
Friends of Timberline and the Forest Service have undertaken to do oral histories of original builders, but that didn't start until the 1970s, and artists, insofar as they were able to do that. And but it's thin by comparison of what it might have been, of course. But yes, that's right, that Marjorie Hoffman Smith, who was the interior designer of the lodge, was interviewed several times, actually, and is pictured on a video that's shown up at the lodge.
Hmm.
So. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Our topic this morning is the New Deal legacy, what government can do at its best. And we'll go to our next caller. Joe, good morning.
Hey, good morning, good morning. Hey, so a couple things, and I hope I'm not going too far afield. First, a comment and then a quick question. What are the legacies of... the New Deal, of course, was the Glass-Steagall Act and all of the acts that really worked to rein in the capitalist machine. And we were doing pretty good, I noticed, until they repealed Glass-Steagall under Bill Clinton. And I think that was a real loss to lose that landmark legislation. And many people are saying that that is what has actually led to the whole banking debacle.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, your question.
Oh, and can I ask a question?
Yeah, really quickly. Mm-hmm.
So, and again, I apologize for this. It's too off the field, and it's kind of an economics question. Do the guests have any idea what to do if, say, for example, our foreign creditors, China, et cetera, decide to stop buying Treasury bonds and really take away all of our money? Any questions on that? And thank you for your answers.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. You have a response to that?
Yeah. Well, in answer to the last, I don't. I'm a geographer, not an economist, so I don't know. But I'm getting pretty nervous myself about what might happen if that happens. Our debt's getting awfully big. But in answer to the second one, which now escapes my memory, I shouldn't answer the last question first. What was the first one? Oh, yes, Glass-Steagall.
Yes.
Yes, that was one of the landmark legislations that came out of the New Deal, and it was to prevent banks from involving themselves in both savings and investment, mixing Wall Street with the banking establishment, mm-hmm. because that's actually what many people felt precipitated the crash of 1929. Mm-hmm. And it's we have economists such as Paul Krugman and Steagall mm-hmm. Who feel that, yes, Bill Clinton should get a great deal more credit for the crash that happened 2 years ago, because it was under his watch that the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in order to let the market rip. And it certainly did rip. And then about 2 years ago, as everybody remembers now, it did its inevitable thing. It crashed. And yes, I would say that if anything can be blamed for it, it would be the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
We're speaking this morning with Gray Brecken and Sarah Monroe about the New Deal. And as you were reflecting on the 1930s, it occurred to me that we might want to explore something that I think we hear a lot today. One thing we hear a lot today is attacks upon government and the federal government being called everything from Nazi to communist to fascist and mm-hmm. all those terms together. Could either of you two address some of the nature of the opposition that Mr. Roosevelt faced from the economic and political left and right? Mr. Brecken, you talked about Mr. Roosevelt saving capitalism, but certainly he was attacked from the left and the right. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. There were people on the far left who actually disliked Roosevelt almost as much as those on the far right, because they felt that he had short-circuited the revolution that they were looking forward to. I don't recommend revolutions normally, because they're not a lot of fun, and what we probably would have gotten would have been a second Civil War. So you did have opponents, but the main opposition was on the right, big business, which at first supported Roosevelt because conditions were so dire when he came in. But after about 6 months or so, when they saw the lengths to which he would go to regulate business, then they began turning against him. And there was a very powerful organization called the American Liberty League, which was largely set up by the DuPont family, which is a family that largely owns Delaware and much else beside. The Mellons were involved in it. Many of the very wealthy people were. And they were very instrumental in trying to turn the country against Roosevelt. Remember that almost all of the publishers in America, the newspaper publishers, were opposed to Roosevelt and the New Deal. It's remarkable that he actually was so popular that he was elected to four administrations because people loved him so much, because most people, I should say a majority of people, felt that he actually was helping them and helping the country. So, yes, and then it went actually to the right of the American Liberty League. You had people who were actually Nazi sympathizers, and there were a number of those in the United States we tend to forget. But there was tremendous opposition to Roosevelt at that time.
When you mentioned Nazis and communism, what it brings to mind with the New Deal to me is the Federal Theater project, which was really shut down because it was these feelings that there were communists in the theater project, people who were of the extreme left, and it was really sad that that program was stopped because it was an extremely creative, fabulous program. Hallie Flanagan, who was in charge of that program, had some terrific things, and there were things going on in Portland, too. These plays, they wanted to do a Paul Bunyan festival up at Timberline that never took place because at least in part because the project was shut down. And those same accusations of leftists and communists, although I think at that time in the 30s that communism really meant something different than it came to mean in the 50s, but it was unfortunate.
Well, it came to mean something different, and also you did have a bit of a burgeoning of it in the South, too, which was kind of removed from some of what we're talking about here in the Northwest geographically and ideologically. One of the things that I wanted to touch upon before we go to our next round of callers was some of the different aspects of the manifestation of the New Deal. Now, we're talking about it with regard to employment, and we talked about it with regard to banks and economy and with regard to politics. But there's a couple of other areas that I think is really important to hear about. And you kind of touched on it a little bit, Sarah, and that's the New Deal and what it did for the arts. People don't talk about that. Arts and also how women benefited, because we talked about the CCC with regard and the WPA with regard to what it did for men. But I want to hear a little bit more about the arts and also how it affected women, because there were programs that benefited them as well.
That's right. With the arts program, there were a number of different New Deal programs that gave employment to artists. There was the section program, under which a lot of the post offices received murals. Many of those in Oregon, actually, Grants Pass, Ontario, Burns, in Portland, East Portland.
Rose City Park.
That's a school.
The school has a mural, too, doesn't it?
Two murals by Martina Gangel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Those were under the Federal Art Project, but the section was responsible for some of these post office murals. And the murals in the state capitol were Depression era. And then the public schools were under the Federal Art Project. And a lot of the and the art, the C.S. Price murals up at Timberline Lodge, all of the oil paintings, in fact, were done under the Federal Art Project. The Federal Art Project also, under what became Federal One, there was the art, there were the writers, the theater project, the Historical Records Survey, and the music project that put musicians, had a small orchestra under Mr. Goodrich. I think that one of the really big benefits to the arts that came out, too, was to the artists themselves.
Yes, that's what I wanted to talk about. What was the philosophy that was at work here? Artists needed to be employed, of course, but what was the thinking?
Well, the first idea was to give them work, but nationally they began to, the leaders of the art project really felt that Americans didn't know about art. Many of them had never seen any art, and this really opened up people's eyes and gave every man the opportunity to see real art in their post office, in their school, and it gave the artists themselves the idea that they might be able to earn a living producing art, that was a completely new phenomenon. Previously, they'd had to have some kind of a wealthy patron before the New Deal, and it definitely happened to artists in Oregon as well.
So people were able to see the functionality of art, and art was integrated and had a refining process on us. Not to say that we were necessarily savages, but just that to have art integrated into your everyday life took your mind to higher regions.
Exactly. And it idealized our kind of, there was a social realism that was a portrayal that was common in New Deal art. And it really kind of idealized labor, work. It really dignified a lot of American lives for people. You asked me about women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And under the art projects, I read a statistic one place that said that about 47% of the artists were women. I think that's nationally. I don't think that was that high in Oregon. Maybe it was, though. There were women artists in Oregon. But
We had Ms. Grangle. We had
Martina Gangle,
yeah.
That's right. And, Charlotte Mesh. There were a number. But 47% is almost equal. And
yes.
But the CCC was all men, and the WPA was mostly men. And the idea there was that it would be the breadwinner earner who got the employment, and only one family member was allowed to receive employment under the New Deal, under a WPA project. And so that kind of cut a wife out of being able to be employed. Most of the women were employed as seamstresses under the Women's and Professional Projects in Oregon, about 78%.
But they did employ an awful lot of teachers and archivists, librarians as well, too.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Under the Writers Project, there were women in Oregon, too.
Well, Frances Perkins was the Secretary of Labor. Does she have an impact in terms of the role of women?
Yes. And there were supervisors here in Oregon, too. Mary Jane Sperlin, who was in charge of the Women's and Professional Project, was a woman lawyer, early Oregon woman lawyer, and Gladys Everett, also a lawyer, early woman, and Marjorie Hoffman Smith, notably, the interior designer of Timberline Lodge. But those women were highly educated kind of at the supervisory level of these projects. But that's right.
And actually, Frances Perkins' role is just now beginning to really be recognized. There's a wonderful new biography by Kristen Downey called The Woman Behind the New Deal, because her papers were largely sealed up until fairly recently. And so now that we can study those papers, we're really beginning to learn the tremendous importance of Perkins as kind of the intellectual force behind much of the New Deal.
I should mention, too, that Dorothea Lange, who was a photographer under the Farm Security Project, took many photographs in rural Oregon. There was an exhibit of her photographs or some of her photographs taken in Oregon at Portland State, and that's been moved, I think it's a similar photo exhibit that's down at the People's Museum in Bay City, and it will be there until May 31st.
Oh, and let me just say that to its credit, the Portland Museum, too, has, I think, two rooms that are show WPA art on permanent display. I wish we had the same thing down here in San Francisco, because they have a tremendous number of WPA works, but they're almost never seen by the public.
That's right. There are some WPA paintings up in the museum on permanent display, and I think they've put up several additional ones as well, and they've took an effort to show representational New Deal art and some abstract art as well.
And one of the things I want to say about the art, and then we'll go to our callers, is that some of the art was social commentary art, too. And I wanted to get back to Martina Gangel's, the name of it, Children of the Poor.
Yes.
Children of the Poor, that's it. And so you had a legacy not only of the creativity, but of the chronicling.
Yes.
Of what was going on in the world. Any comments about some of the social commentary of the art?
Martina Gangel was definitely very conscious of the social inequities. She portrayed many times mother and child, sometimes in very sad circumstances. Mm-hmm. That's right.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. here in the city, and we'll go to our caller that's been patiently waiting. Thank you so much for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a very fascinating program. I wanted to, 2 points. The first one, just to kind of reemphasize the importance of the argument that the New Deal was perhaps largely influential in creating a large middle class versus the World War II, and therefore the argument for militarism, and that has really been a constant argument throughout history. You know, is it does the Constitution mean that we should support for the common defense, but not the general welfare? Is often an argument here from the right, and of course this is an argument just to the opposite of that. My second point is that one thing where the model of the New Deal instituted back in the 30s and after that needs to be considered when we're going forward is that at that time, you know, it was also an expansion of industrialization of civilization. And are we really capable of doing that any longer? So that for example, such things as peak oil, where now, the amount of energy that we can get out of the earth compared to at that time is now not expanding. It's now should be retracting, if not now, but very shortly. And therefore, we can't really depend on that fuel source, but more things like a smarter design, such as permaculture, where we're relocalizing our food production, and also, of course, transportation, the fact that we've gone into the interstate highway.
Oh, caller, we're short on time, so if you could make your point in like 5 seconds, please.
Sure, yes. So just to emphasize that any New Deal can't be based on, for example, the model of growth or industrialization.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
And it certainly was not on the minds of anybody in the New Deal, as far as I know. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that Bonneville Dam was the biggest New Deal project at a cost of like $81 million, employed 4,000 workers. And that was probably Roosevelt's favorite project in the state of Oregon. And it certainly made a big difference to the way of, as the caller was saying, to people's way of life. And it gave birth to the possibility of this rural electrification program, where they were able to give electricity to a lot of farms that really, before the Depression, did not have lights. It made a huge difference in the way people lived.
Dr. Brecken.
Yes.
You started to say something. I cut you off.
Well, I also just wanted to say the aid to public education, the enormous expansion in public education, including building many of our community colleges at that time, was really instrumental in creating the middle class after the Second World War, although very few people make that connection. Mm-hmm. I would also like not to forget that the New Deal, the Resettlement Agency administration, and then the Farm Securities Administration actually had some experimental towns around the country. In particular, I'm thinking of Greenbelt, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., in which there were actually experiments with trying to make largely self-sufficient communities, and most of those did not work.
That's right.
Could you tell us why they didn't work? What was some of the forces that pulled them apart?
Well, they were embedded in the capitalist system, and so it's very difficult to have a cooperative system embedded in a capitalist system, which in fact has active enmity towards them. And there was tremendous enmity towards those towns in Congress itself, because it was Rexford Tugwell and Eleanor Roosevelt who were largely behind those, and there were many Congress people who just hated those people. So they did everything that they could to make sure that those towns didn't work.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm here with my co-host, Celeste Carey. Our topic this morning is the New Deal legacy, what government at its best can do. Our guest is Ray Brecken, who is the visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and founder of and project scholar of California's Living Deal Project. Dr. Brecken will speak at Portland State University on Tuesday at 7 p.m. at Smith Center, Room 238. And also joining us is Sarah Baker Monroe, who is a board member of the National New Deal Preservation Association and the author of Timberline Lodge, The History, Art, and Craft of American Icon. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I guess that's me.
Yes.
What I'm seeing clearly is that as a society, we appear to be regressing. I think that today what we're lacking is we're lacking the political will, okay? We're also lacking collective will as well, you know? I mean, we have all the resources. We have the models. We have everything else, but why is it that we're lacking the political leadership and the collective will to do these things? That's what I want to know. So whatever your thoughts are on
that.
Well,
thanks, caller. You know, I think part of it was indicated, if I'm not mistaken, Gray, when you were talking about why the experimental towns didn't succeed. There's no desire to stop making money.
Yes, well, capitalism can be pretty corrosive in that way. And the New Deal was really about emphasizing communality, the idea that we're all in this together and that the United States should be united, that, you know, we're a community. And what you had then in the 60s was the left began to attack the government, largely because of Vietnam and civil rights, et cetera, but that was really taken up then by the master salesman of all time, Ronald Reagan, who really began people thinking in terms of the government as them rather than us. And that idea is tremendously corrosive to any conception of a democracy. And we now really see the sort of poison fruits of that in these hate rallies, literal hate rallies that we're seeing all around the country that are directed partly at the president, but largely at the government itself.
Mm. Okay, so what about the people? We the people. Why aren't we standing up and demanding change? I mean, it seems like there was more activism on the ground back in the, you know, during the Great Depression than there is now. Certainly more during the 60s, okay? Now it's like people are not, they're just so dead, you know? I mean, nobody's getting up and demanding change, and things are so dire. This is a serious, serious thing. We're spending all of our resources on war, on killing people, on destruction. I mean, I don't understand. Really, well, why people aren't more up in arms and out there doing stuff and telling, you know, demanding change like we were at one time.
Thank you. Thank you, Colin.
I think this would take a college seminar. I don't have the time for it. But part of it is that in the 1930s, you had very strong unions. Reagan largely destroyed those. There was a strong union movement. But also we've had progressively the replacement of education with entertainment. And that, again, has been extremely corrosive. As public education has been destroyed, entertainment has flowed in to fill the void. And that entertainment is largely passive. People just watch. They don't become involved. And I think that that has a great deal to do with it.
I think, too, the complexity of life today is a little different. I think people don't see and know the business owners around them the way they did in the 40s and 30s. And but I also would take issue with the fact that people just got up in arms and pulled together in the Depression, because I really think it took these New Deal programs to garner people together, to give them some optimism. I think they felt very helpless and isolated and really needed the government programs to get themselves started feeling more optimistic and positive and together.
That's a great point, because what you had there was this extraordinary personality of Franklin and, well, two personalities, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, in Washington, and a tremendous sense of possibility. When I read accounts of people who went to work for Roosevelt at that time, you get the sense that the windows had suddenly been thrown open, mm-hmm. and that almost anything was possible, because he just gave people such a long leash to experiment.
But certainly he gave them a leash to experiment, but he wasn't without strong opposition. What was it, just something in his DNA that gave them the ability to resist the opposition that was there?
Yes, be able to withstand.
I think so. I think it was his terrific charisma. I think that he just, his voice had such confidence in it. I think he just made people feel hopeful. When he came here to Timberline, he was physically so helpless. I mean, he was so paralyzed, and yet he would stand up there on that terrace and say, "Here I am on the slopes of Mount Hood, where I've always wanted to come." I just think he was so positive. He made people feel in hopeful that they could do something and that he was with them. There were a lot of people who would write letters to him personally saying, you know, "My family's suffering. I need help. Please help me." I think they felt that personal connection. They felt that he might be listening to them.
And they did with Eleanor, too, because I read some of the letters that people wrote to her. She read many of them, and then she would, if somebody was really in dire straits, she would actually forward a request over to Harry Hopkins, the head of the WPA, to try to get these people work. So there was a real direct connection with people.
You are listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking about Another World Was Possible, the New Deal and its legacy. And joining us this morning is Dr. Brecken, who will tour Oregon. I'm talking about the New Deal, and he will speak tomorrow evening at Portland State University. And also with us is a Oregonian who is a local wonderful resource person about the legacy of the New Deal, Sarah Monroe, and is also the author of Timberline Lodge, The History, Art, and Craft of American Icon.
You know, I wanted to say something. I know this is a couple of decades removed, but when the caller was asking about how we've become even more disconnected and have lost some of the lessons, the object lessons of the New Deal, I was thinking of Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. And one of the reasons I guess all of this kind of came to my mind is I was out driving in to see the falls out in Multnomah Falls at the falls yesterday and went out to the Bonneville Dam and everything. And I remember passing one of the Grange Halls. And I was thinking about how we, in many ways in the New Deal, it was kind of that pinnacle of come-togetherness that we had. And so we don't have those same sensitivities and sensibilities now. It's though a lot of the object lessons have kind of dissolved, that idea of let's get in here and pull together. Any thoughts on that?
I think there is some of that, I just think that people move around so much now, it's harder to get that sense of community. To a certain extent, I think the internet has depersonalized our ability to make connections with people. We don't have to always speak to them. A lot of times we're just writing a quick little email that can be very, well, brusque because it's very brief, and we don't have the same ways of interacting that we did in the 30s. And we need to make more of a conscious effort to make those interactions happen and make that sense of community to build our groups of friends and family support. I think it's really important. There was, this is just kind of a different point, but it is something that I wanted to make quickly, and that is that I think there are many, many people in the state of Oregon who are aware of New Deal projects and are really impassioned about them. And it would be wonderful if we could do a similar thing to what Gray has been able to do in the state of California, which is to have this Living New Deal project where we could have an inventory of the parks, the tunnels, the bridges, Timberline Lodge, as a resource, a united resource together where we could have a complete listing. I think would be a wonderful way to celebrate the New Deal today.
And Dr. Brecken, we'll give you the last word.
Pardon?
We'll give you the last word.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say that we have developed the platform for doing exactly that here at UC Berkeley with the California's Living New Deal Project. And we have a map of California, and we continually are adding Google information points to it as people feed it to us. We're looking for partners in other states or perhaps nationally. So anytime that anybody in Oregon who has the institutional longevity to do so wants it, we can give them the start doing that.
Thank you so much. And let me remind you that you can hear Dr. Gray Brecken at Portland State University tomorrow evening. He will lecture at 7 p.m. at Smith Center, Room 238. And we wanted to thank Dr. Gray Brecken and Sarah Baker Monroe for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. This has been More Talk Radio. Stay tuned. We have coming up the Old Mole Variety Hour.